Hi, everyone. I'm Chris Aldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Talks Education Podcast. This month, we're interviewing Professors Joshua Weishart and Jonathan Feingold. Professor Weishart is the Thomas R. Goodwin Professor of Law in the West Virginia University's College of Law, and Professor Feingold is an Associate Professor in the School of Law at Boston University. On this month's podcast, Professor Weishart and Feingold discuss recent attacks on public education, including book bans, attacks on curricula and teachers, and attacks on historically marginalized and minoritized students and families. So in recent years, we've seen a rise in attacks on what schools teach and how teaching happens in schools. So how would you characterize these attacks? For example, are they attacks on free speech or intellectual freedom? And then as you think about that, where would you say we are in the legal landscape today? Do we know, for example, whether book bans are unconstitutional?
So the answer to the first part of that question, are these attacks on free speech? Are they attacks on intellectual freedom? The incomplete answer is yes. And as recently as this past Monday, one component of Florida, one of Florida's discriminatory censorship laws, generally known as the Stop Woke Act, was again found to be unconstitutional, this time by a court of appeals, on speech grounds, and a provision that specifically applied to private entities. But I think it's really understating what this now vast body of legislation, often being passed at the state and local level, does. And it is, you know, it's attacks on free speech in certain ways. It's also attacks on students' right to learn. It's attacking students' right to the truth about many things. It's also a concerted campaign to undermine democracy through sites of education and to stigmatize certain groups and to legitimize all sorts of existing inequalities through a unavoidable nostalgia for a pre-civil rights era. And so it's all of those things.
And Chris, you asked about the legal landscape. You know, it's of course always in flux because you're constantly adding new laws and regulations and court decisions. But I think it's fair to say that these what we characterize as discriminatory censorship laws that we've seen have been unique and indeed unprecedented in their design and their scope and the pace at which they have been adopted. And so it took some time before you started to see a critical mass of legal challenges brought against these discriminatory laws. And now that we have had a few high-profile challenges and decisions, the pathways to a successful legal challenge, they're clearer, but they're still generally uninviting. And that's because existing court precedent gives legislative bodies and executive agencies pretty substantial discretion over education policy, especially when it comes to curriculum and the classroom instruction. And against that favored discretion, you have teachers who have relatively few settled First Amendment rights, and a Supreme Court that's been constricting, retracting the rights of the constitutional rights of students for decades. And so the few legal paths that remain for teachers and students to really challenge these laws take us into some uncharted territory where we have persuasive theories of liability. It's just that they haven't been fully tried and tested yet. And some haven't been tried and tested because to prevail, you have to, on some of these theories, you have to meet fairly demanding standards of proof. And you have courts which have been unwilling to draw bright lines between legitimate forms of inculcation of values in education versus indoctrination. And they prefer to just defer to the judgment of lawmakers.
And if if I could just say one more thing about the legality of these laws, many of which it's quite clear were passed, many if not all, as part of a broader backlash to the summer of 2020 and a national leaning into an attempt to really interrogate all the ways in which racism and other social forces impact all of our lives in public spaces and private spaces, and are really have targeted both members of the LGBTQ community, those communities writ large, through language and narratives that really stigmatize those groups, but also other communities of colors and Black Americans in particular. And so for those reasons, there are independent sort of equal protection sort of concerns that render these laws fraught. But even if lawsuits that have been filed challenging these laws prove successful, that won't undo the damage that these laws have already wrought. And the students who will pass through years of school with teachers who are afraid to have basic conversations that, as we talk about in our report, create very predictably increase the likelihood that students from targeted groups are going to have to go through school, not just without access to a comprehensive curriculum, but in environments that create a heightened threat of race and gender-based harassment.
It's interesting because we are talking about the law, and the law is often taken up by folks as, you know, it's the rules of the game, and the rules are written down and everybody can, if they want to play by the rules. But I think it's so interesting in talking with both of you and then just thinking about these issues that we're facing now, you can't disentangle the politics. And so I want to ask you all a series of questions about the various stakeholders that are involved in some of the issues that we're talking about. One being parents. So often now, advocates of these anti-woke laws or Moms for Liberty groups are arguing that, you know, parents have rights and they have rights over what their kids are taught. And we know that parent involvement in education is important. So I guess I'm wondering, what are parents' rights to their students' education? And how, if at all, do these rights come in conflict with the purpose of schools to educate kids with diverse backgrounds?
Yeah, so as we explained in our report, as you mentioned, Chris, proponents of these discriminatory censorship laws have frequently invoked parental rights to justify these laws. And the reality is, though, that parental rights cannot justify them. It's true that the Supreme Court has recognized the right of parents to control the education and upbringing of their children, but that parental right has a relatively narrow application. Courts have concluded that parental rights, in fact, are not grounds for exempting students from the public school curriculum. And even when parental rights do apply, they only grant individual parents the right to opt out their own child from the state mandated curriculum. They don't give parents the right to dictate the curriculum for other children. And the Supreme Court has long recognized the authority of state and schools to set the curriculum, deliver the instruction, as I was mentioning before, and the idea being to promote civic and democratic values. And, you know, parental rights do not impose any significant limitation in that regard. The only significant limit on state and local authorities in terms of setting the curriculum is that they be consistent and clear in setting their standards. And so if the curricular standards are inconsistent and or ambiguous, then that raises actually First Amendment and due process concerns. And that's the problem that we see with these discriminatory censorship laws is generally they are intentionally vague and ambiguous, and they leave educators to wonder where to draw the line on censored topics and what is lawful versus unlawful. And that in turn creates, causes them, the educators, to self-censor rather than take the risk of guessing wrong.
And the only thing that I'll add is that any conversation about parents' rights should, of course, attend to just the law with respect to the authority parents have to determine the upbringing of their children, but also ask the narrative question or the rhetorical question, why is it that the groups that promoted what remains a regime of discriminatory censorship and were leaders in the backlash to the summer of 2020, why did they take on the, why did they adopt the language of parents' rights? And part of it is because when you articulate your goals or your concerns through the rhetoric of parents' rights, it's performing at least three functions. One is that, and this is, you see this in other contexts as well, but it's flipping the sort of victim-perpetrator dynamic. The predicate for the very modest changes that we saw in school districts across the country arose out of, like, oftentimes abhorrent incidents of students engaging in the most insensitive, if not violent racial conduct. So, like, there's stories from multiple districts of students holding, like, slave auctions, stuff like that, and schools attempting to respond. And then when you invoke the rhetoric of parents' rights, you're able to sort of shift the burden. You now have to put you're placing the burden on the school to demonstrate why it's necessary to make any sort of change. But there's also this veneer of neutrality. It's that you're not actually committed to a particular ideological goal or end. You just want parents to have rights, which obscures that this has never been about parents writ large determining the upbringing of their children. It's never been about ensuring that the parents of LGBTQ kids are able to access schools where their kids can feel safe and free from harassment and discrimination. This is about empowering a very select minority of parents who hold pretty radical views. And then it's also about obscuring what those views are. Because when we're talking about parents' rights, in the same way that when we're talking about states' rights in the aftermath of the Civil War, we're not actually asking, well, what is it the thing that you want states to be able to do? Which then is to sort of maintain a racial order defined by slavery. And so when you talk about parents' rights, you're not asking the question, well, really, like, what is the political agenda of these groups? What is it that they want to do substantively, which is deeply unpopular if you just look at national polling. And so the rhetorical move is, at least for me, often as important a topic as the legality.
It's interesting to think about the battles that are being had in districts now that are political in nature, but that in some ways will be informed by what happens in courts. But there's a lag. All of these questions that are going through the courts now are probably going to take years to be settled, to become settled law, if that will ever happen. I don't know. You two know more about that than I do. But is there any place that district leaders, school board members, superintendents that are interested in pushing back against some of the arguments that you're talking about, Jonathan, where they can look for guidance around what they should be doing to protect their families and their kids from these kinds of attacks that come from a small radical group?
One thing that we've seen, or that some folks who our focus on school boards all the time know, and many of us have just been made aware of, is that school boards do hold tremendous power locally, often in establishing and directing the governance of local schools and districts. And it was strategic for folks like Steve Bannon and others to identify school boards as a specific site of organizing individuals who held right-wing views to gain formal power that could then be exercised. But there's nothing that in the same way that school boards flipped one direction to the right, there's nothing to suggest that they can't flip back. And if anything, increasing evidence shows from school board elections over the last, I think, at least 2 years, that individuals, community members, parents who are running for school board positions who articulate an affirmative, positive vision of public education and commit to creating spaces where students obtain both a comprehensive understanding and literacy regarding the history of this country and in which all children are safe, they're winning. They're defeating the MAGA style candidates that continue to rehearse a pretty now worn script that at certain points proved effective, but no longer is. And you have folks like Jennifer Berkshire and Jack Schneider who are hypothesizing that one of the reasons that more progressive candidates are winning is because that actually reflects the values of parents and individuals in the community who now also see that the sort of anti-racism backlash wasn't actually about kids, but it was actually part of a broader agenda to undermine or really dismantle and defund public education. And for pretty much every parent who has a kid in public school, public education is one of the most, if not the most important public good.
Yeah, and I guess I would just build on the idea that in terms of districts wanting to push back, they have the law on their side in the sense that if there's one unifying principle, it is that public education is supposed to democratize school children, to prepare them to participate in a responsible, responsibly and productively as democratic citizens. And, you know, that's a principle that actually enjoys universal support in Supreme Court precedent and state constitutions and state court decisions. And it's rare for a principle to reach that level of unanimity in the law. And districts armed with the discretion that they have can pursue what Jonathan was saying about an affirmative, inclusive, culturally sensitive pedagogy in order to prepare their students for life in a multicultural, multiracial democracy. And what these discriminatory censorship laws do are it's essentially to undercut, it's antithetical to the vision of democratic education, right? It directly undercuts the purpose of public education by privileging these exclusionary values, by restricting the flow of truthful information and stifling critical thought and inquiry, and even jeopardizing the health and well-being of children. And so I think there's a lot that school districts could do in terms of leveraging the law to push back against this agenda.
So I want to ask you about that. I want to give you two hypotheticals to think about and then see how you would respond to both. The first is, if we imagine that there is a state, perhaps where the majority of districts within that state are experiencing the kind of school board elections that you talked about, Jonathan, where folks are winning that have the progressive values that want to protect public education. But there are maybe a handful of districts within that state where they are taking on local control to do some of the harmful things that we are experiencing nationwide. Are there things that that state can do to protect students in those districts that may be a minority among a somewhat radical majority?
One relevant consideration is, what is the state in the sense of who controls the governor's office and really the legislature in that state? Because if you are in a state that is democratically controlled, and I say democratically controlled not to be partisan, but just because as a descriptive matter, the individuals passing discriminatory censorship laws are Republican in terms of the party. It is really now central to the GOP's platform. And so if you're I'm in Massachusetts right now, nothing prevents the state legislature and the governor from signing into law laws that protect the rights of teachers to teach comprehensive curriculum and the rights of students to have access to it and to also be explicit with respect to the educational standards. And so that Massachusetts now has at least a number of bills that are pending that are attempting to do some of these things. States like Illinois have already passed some, including some that essentially incorporate, I believe it's the Librarian Bill of Rights, though I might have that the language a little bit wrong, but essentially creates a presumption against book bans. And so there is precedent for blue states taking action at the state level to prevent localities from compromising the educational experience of their students. Another thing that, again, states could do if they're so inclined is their attorney general office, in the same way that the federal government through the Department of Education or civil rights can open investigations against districts in which there is evidence of racial or gender-based harassment that is violating student civil rights arising either under state or federal law. And we have seen that in a few instances, but I'm not aware of many.
And again, I'll say that states, in acting in the way that Jonathan is proposing, again, have significant leverage because, Chris, every state constitution contains a right to education, a right to a quality and equitable education, a right to a democratic education. And so certainly, if you have rogue districts who are adopting discriminatory censorship laws or practices, the state can exert the state constitutional right to education. And by the way, the state government has the ultimate responsibility of guaranteeing that every student in that state has an adequate and equitable education. And so the state is armed with a great deal of legal authority in exerting that authority over local districts that are going rogue or adopting unlawful practices.
I'm sure you could imagine what the next hypothetical is going to be, where I just switch it and I just ask, what if the state, not to pick on Florida or Texas, but what if the state is controlled by a majority that is proposing these kinds of laws? What kinds of rights, I don't know if they would be considered rights, but what kinds of rights do districts have or local communities have to be able to push back? Or is that attention at all?
This is a moment in which the federal government and national well-resourced organizations are critical. Because we right now live in two countries when it comes to education. And you could think of sort of pre-Civil War, there was a federal government, there were free states and there were slave states. When it comes to education, we have that now. We have open states and we have censored states. And in those censored states, as a result of sometimes through some semblance of majority will, but generally through different forms of gerrymandering in which the GOP has been able to coalesce and centralize power within the state government through different mechanisms. Florida is a great example. North Carolina is a very good example where there's a veto. The state legislature's Republican Party has essentially a veto now. The ability to override the governor's veto because of how they've consolidated power, Texas as well. And those states, they're unabashed in wielding that power. And so certainly there's ways that local municipalities can respond. But if you are in Texas right now, or if you're in Florida, like physically in the state, you're under tremendous threat. And it would be, I think, a little naive to think that we should expect individuals in those states or district leaders in those states to be doing all the work. And this is really where the Department of Education or the Justice Department needs to step in alongside, again, national civil rights organizations.
Yeah, we can't overburden the local districts, but I'll say that, you know, there's nothing stopping the local school districts from also exerting the state constitutional right to education. And in fact, if you, and typically that is what happens frequently in school funding cases, where the school districts are being deprived of adequate resources and sue the state and take on the legislature, essentially, for underfunding education. And so I think, as a last resort, certainly local districts could consider mounting constitutional challenges, state constitutional challenges, where a state government is, infringing on the right to education itself.
So you've both mentioned now that most of these attacks are targeted at historically marginalized and minoritized groups. What recommendations would you provide to folks that identify as historically marginalized or minoritized to push back against some of these attacks?
So I think this is particularly a moment in which we cannot expect nor ask the individuals who are being targeted and the groups that are being targeted to always be on the front lines taking the lead. Somewhat shallow, self-interested standpoint, if you're anyone in the United States and you benefit from and prefer a truly democratic society, then this is also your fight. And this is not disconnected from attacks on reproductive autonomy that we are seeing. It's not disconnected from attacks on voting rights, which is an assault on the liberties and freedoms of all Americans. But I think we've certainly witnessed that there has not been a broad public outcry and real sense of urgency when it has come to the sort of spread of discriminatory censorship laws. We saw a little bit of that when Florida passed its Don't Say Gay bill. And that's, I think, interesting. And like, we should be asking why a law that was targeting the LGBTQ community, which obviously is multiracial itself, just created more of a sense of urgency than laws that were really targeting, or at least most detrimental to students of color and communities of color. And so really it's a moment for everyone in every state to try to identify how they can support efforts to resist a creep that, to the extent there is a GOP president, we will see Florida nationalized through the Department of Education. I think that is a 100% guarantee. And so being in Massachusetts, as an example, would provide some buffer, but this is a fight that everyone should recognize they are a part of.
Well, I mean, in terms of what John was just saying about, it becoming a national issue, I think we have to expect our political leaders to make it one. And I think that's why, you know, in our report, we called on Congress to hold hearings on these laws and draw attention, national attention, to what a serious threat they pose for education. And we'd also expect, U.S. Department of Education to lead in issuing guidance and in committing more resources and energy to investigating civil rights complaints. Example. So, I think we expect our national leaders to rise to the occasion and to call attention to this issue.
And I really appreciate Josh raising that, because I also want to just say a few more words about what we see as sort of necessary or at minimum important steps that various stakeholders can take. And one is to provide far more support to teachers on the front line, particularly in hostile states. Both those who have already faced what is effectively retaliation for often modest efforts to ensure that all of their students are receiving an adequate education. And I'm thinking of people like Amy Donofrio in Florida, who was nationally recognized for the work that she was doing with her students by President Obama before she was targeted. And she recently had a hearing in Florida a couple weeks ago in which she was having to defend her right to maintain her teaching license. And she's been out of the classroom since this started and was called out by name by a state official. There needs to be a massive public presence outside her hearing in support for her, showing solidarity with her. That can't happen because it's passed. But another person, Matt Hahn, who is a name that I think many people will remember, Tennessee teacher, 11th grade, who taught a class on Ta-Nehisi Coates and other material. And he was also targeted and terminated for really doing what I think the vast majority of Americans would want their kids' teachers to do, cultivate a sort of curious, thoughtful environment for discussion. He has an appeal hearing coming up in the end of April. I do think that it's important optically and for other reasons for there to be a visible presence supporting him, because every time a teacher is targeted and there is not that support, it sends a message to every other teacher in the state. And it has the predictable effect of precluding them from even engaging in what remains openly lawful activities because of the threat of targeted retaliation, which is sort of a long-winded way of saying that in the same way that if you had a right-wing vigilante engage in arguably unlawful violence and then be championed by the right. They would get on every TV show. They would be flown around in private jets. They would get their own brand. There needs to be a real sort of similar response in championing frontline educators who are doing some of the, like, have some of the hardest and most important jobs in the country when they're targeted. And that's really a call on everyone to think about how they can financially and otherwise support folks who are under threat. Because again, if the people who get the most national attention, like, still don't get the support they need, that sends a devastating message to every teacher in a state where they know they have a hostile government.
Thank you again, Professors Weishart and Feingold, for being on this month's podcast. As always, we hope you're safe and healthy. And remember, for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu.